Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome to this week's episode of the TLS podcast. I'm Alex Clark and Lucy Dallas, the TLS's arts editor, is here with me. Hi, Lucy. I always say, how are you doing? But well, I kind of know because I actually saw you in real life.
It was so exciting to see you in real life.
So exciting. What it was, listeners, we planned a really epic and cultural walk, taking in all sorts of high points of wonderful things that we might see and discuss and might nurture our mind. But it was really raining, wasn't it, Lucy? So we went to a lovely tea shop and had scones.
That's what we did. And we did, at one point, we did think, well, we saw an exhibition and went, oh, we should go to that. And then halfway through, we said, oh, we should go for a walk. We go for a walk. Oh, no, it's raining. So we
still
did.
Raining. Still raining, sadly. Yeah, I know, that terrible scones. Thing that someone says when they see an exhibition, go past it and think we should do that instead of going for tea and scones. Oh, it's on for ages, we said. And we know what, oh, it's on for ages means in real life, don't we?
Yes.
It means suddenly it'll be over tomorrow and we'll be going, oh God. Anyway, never mind. It was very nice. We did talk about some various cultural matters and launch our grand plans for our podcast.
Yep, great big plans afoot and lots of wonderful things on this week.
Yes, indeed. So let's get straight into it, because this week, Miranda France joins us to talk about the publication of a final novel by Gabriel Garcia Marquez and Nicola Shulman on what women write in their diaries. Plus TLS poetry editor Camille Ralphs reads a poem from her new collection. But first, last week saw the global publication of Until August, a final novel from Gabriel Garcia Marquez that comes 10 years after his death. The novelist had abandoned it, telling his sons Rodrigo and Gonzalo that it didn't work and must be destroyed. However, after much consideration, they decided to retrieve the manuscript from their father's archive and let readers decide. Miranda France, the TLS's editor for Spain, Portugal and Latin America, is one of the very first to make that decision. And she joins us now to give her verdict. Hi, Miranda.
Hello, Alex.
Now, I do realise I've put this in very stark terms, i.e. should or shouldn't Until August have been published. But in your review, you don't equivocate. You say not. Why do you say that?
Well, I think that it's not a very good novel. I'm not sure that it's one that he would have wanted to see the light. And I'm not saying that it necessarily needed to be destroyed. I mean, that quote that they give from their father is very much in the vein of statements made by characters in Garcia Marquez novels. He's, you know, this must be destroyed. It is no good. And I'm not saying they should necessarily have destroyed it, but they could have let it languish in the archive. And it would have been available for scholars to look at. I'm sure it would have been an interesting part of his papers, his archive. But I don't think that it really is good enough to come out as a novel for all of us.
Yes. Well, let's talk about the book a little. I've read it too. It's quite short. It tells the story of a woman who makes a yearly pilgrimage to her mother's grave on an island to lay gladioli. And she has lots of rituals around this trip. But one year she abruptly decides to have a sexual encounter with a fellow hotel guest. And therein starts a sort of rhythm of, I suppose, one night stands once a year.
Yes. I think there are four altogether, aren't there?
Yes, I think that's right. They're all kind of quite different from one another. But what do you think about that setup? What do you make up of that setup?
Well, I think the setup is all right, but the moment of crisis, which I suppose a novel needs a crisis to turn on or a monumental event, comes when she wakes up the next morning and she finds that he has tucked a $20 bill into her copy of Dracula. Page 116, I think, and numbers are often mentioned in Garcia Marquez novels. So this is what throws her into crisis, the fact that he thinks she's a prostitute, and then she begins to worry, you know, is she prostituting herself, and do others see her like that? And I just feel there's something unpleasant about that predicament. It's not interesting, it's not investigated in a imaginative way. It just feels like a way of putting somebody down.
I think this is sort of slightly tangential, but not completely. She's called Anna Magdalena Bach, isn't she?
Yes.
Why is she called that?
Well, there is a musical theme in the book too. I think her husband is director of the local conservatoire. Her son is a very accomplished musician who travels the world, and she herself is interested in music. There are various references to musical pieces, just as there are references to novels as well. And to me, it feels a little bit like a mind that can remember certain headlines, you know, that is hitting particular targets by mentioning interesting works of art, but can't do something interesting with that information.
Right, so you can say, yes, it talks about books and it talks about art, but actually it doesn't cohere because I didn't know whether her life was supposed to have any parallel. It doesn't sound as though it has any parallels
with
Bach's
not.
Wife. It's just sort of, that's the name of someone musical, is it that?
Yes, exactly. And I mean, Miranda, we should say, shouldn't we, that in his final years, Garcia Marquez had dementia, and this is one of the ways in which his sons thought about whether they should publish or not. They thought, when their father said, it's no good, destroy it, he was not quite in a position to be able to judge its quality. And they thought it had greater merit than he did. But one of the things that I was really interested in, and we've talked about it, haven't we? And you say it in your piece, was that there is this business of vocabulary, that he has in other novels a large and rich and various vocabulary that you found quite significantly impoverished here.
Yes, I did. In reading his novels, I would have to, if I was reading them in Spanish, I would have to look up some words, which I don't always have to do when reading in Spanish. And actually, a Spanish colleague said to me only last week that he also found that he had to look up words reading Garcia Marquez in the original. So that's the extent of the vocabulary he uses. And it is his novels are rich and dense in imagery and description. And that just isn't present in this novel, not surprisingly. I mean, there was an interesting take from Wendy Mitchell, you know, the Alzheimer's campaigner who has now died, but she had said when she heard that this Garcia Marquez novel was coming out that it was a great thing to show that people who are dealing with dementia can still produce art, and that this was actually encouraging and a good sign. And I can see that argument, but I still feel that really there's too much on the other side.
Yes, I mean, there is also this suggestion, isn't there, that this is part of what might have at one point been a larger suite of novels, of which Garcia Marquez's last novel to be published in his lifetime, Memories of My Melancholy Whores, is a part. And you make the point that that wasn't quite an uncomfortable book to read too.
Yes, I haven't actually read it. I just saw the reviews of it and felt that I didn't really want to read it. But it's about somebody who wants to celebrate his 90th birthday by sleeping with a 14-year-old virgin, who I think is sedated in the brothel to make it a less traumatic experience for her. Since I haven't read the book, I can't comment on
it. I can't think why you didn't want to read it, Miranda. Do you think, you do mention this in your piece as well, do you think there was a tendency, and I'm trying to remember in his kind of great novels, I don't remember this so much, but do you think there is a tendency in these later ones to do that thing whereby women are characters only according to whether they have sex or not, basically, and then everybody else is allowed to have interesting things going on, but the women, you know, they're either having sex a lot or they're not having sex at all, but that's the thing.
Well, I think that has been a tendency in Latin American fiction, and maybe more widely than that. There's the sort of cheerful prostitute is certainly a mainstay of many Latin American novels, including ones by Vargas Llosa, for example. And García Márquez said that he wrote about prostitutes because he had rented a very cheap room in a brothel when he was a young man, and so he had hung out with them and knew them well. Of course, I mean, there are, I think, a wider range of female characters in his books. So I don't want to say that it's all the virgin or whore, but that dichotomy certainly is present, I think.
We should say that the woman, although in this book, Anna Magdalena Bach, is not a prostitute, even though she is horrified to be taken as one in that first encounter. And I suppose the other way to describe it, to characterize her story, is that of a woman who in middle age is experiencing a degree of sexual freedom. She limits it to this once a year pilgrimage that she makes to her mother's grave, but it enlivens her and it becomes an exciting thing for her in prospect, even when her desires are thwarted. So do you think it sort of does become a kind of slightly more complicated and muddied kind of plot than we might at first think from that sort of basic setup?
Yes, I suppose that is a more generous and feminist perhaps take. I can see an argument for that. And she then goes back home and has quite exciting sex with her husband, doesn't she, in the shower and rolling around on the floor of the bathroom.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yes. Yes. Meanwhile, her daughter, not to really confuse you, Lucy, but then her daughter gets packed up to a nunnery. So, I mean, it's all...
So that does sound a bit...
Yeah, it's all going... Yeah, I'm talking myself out of my own viewpoint here.
But actually, the thing, to take your point, Alex, the thing that it sounded like, Miranda, a bit, or rather that was a possibility from what you said in your review, is that it's the person who sort of spoils it, the person who ruins it and spoils her image and her joy, is the guy who leaves her the $20 note. Is there an argument for saying he's the one who sours everything? It's the guy who screws it up.
Well, he doesn't help, does he? It's true, because she, we should say, thought it was absolutely terrific one-night stand. I mean, quite brilliant and life-changing.
Yes, I just felt she'd been cut down to size somehow. Maybe she did have that. She does take initiative to have a night of passion with a stranger, and that is liberating in some way, but then she so quickly gets cut down to size by the fact that she's taken as a prostitute. And as you say, her daughter is joining a convent, despite being quite a free-spirited person. And I just felt, why are we back with the whores and the nuns again? Why can't they have a more... the son is travelling the world as an accomplished musician. Why couldn't that have been the daughter? I mean, I don't want to be somebody who is always complaining about the treatment of women in books, because I really do believe that people should write the books they would like to write. But I just felt sad about it. And I did read it twice to check that, you know, to see if I wasn't sad the second time, but I still felt sad.
And I mean, you two wouldn't know about this. So the sons have said, we didn't necessarily trust his literary judgment later on, so we thought that the book was worth publishing so that the readers could have it, as it were, and make their own choice.
That's essentially it, yes, precisely. And that they were aware that they were going against their father's wishes, but they felt that somehow his life's work, as you know, his complete works would be unfinished if this wasn't more widely available than simply sitting in his archive. Exactly.
I mean, should we be trusted to make the decision? I'm not sure we should, because we're always going to, because we love the greatest writers, we're always going to want more and more of them. We're always going to want every last bit. You know, anytime they find a new bit of diary that Jane Austen may have written or a letter or something, we always want it. Of course we do. So it's completely natural that we would want to see Garcia Marquez's last novel. But
yes. Yes,
I just feel that he could have been better protected.
May we think then, just because we really dislike people coming onto the podcast and feeling sad. We don't want sadness. That is not
You're
our modus
operandi.
Well, I'm just going to say, let us think, you know, more generally about Garcia Marquez, his most famous works and how he came to prominence, and also those shorter books again that you talk about in the piece, Aranja, because it's a really detailed and really interesting analysis. All those books that reflected his life as a journalist more than 100 Years of Solitude and Love in the Time of Cholera obviously did. He writes all sorts of novels, actually.
Yes, and he always thought of himself as a journalist. He was a journalist from early on. And I was reminded yesterday, I'd forgotten, that the name that he took for his first column was Septimus from Mrs. Dalloway. He was a huge admirer of Virginia Woolf.
Mm.
And he was an admirer too, I think, of Ulysses and James Joyce. And so he was trying to do something similar in some of his books, perhaps especially 100 Years of Solitude, by playing with the sense of time and exploring, as Joyce does, exploring a whole history through, not through one day, but through one family, with such amazing imagination and invention. He's brought me a great deal of happiness, which will outweigh the momentary sadness that I'm feeling now.
Yes. Well, I just want to sort of ask you about that in kind of closing, as we think about his canon and his most famous books. I mean, we know, don't we, that there was, people of our age certainly know, that there was a point where everybody was, again, you say this in your piece, everybody was reading Garcia Marquez. Now, sometimes, decades later, one can see that as a kind of literary fashion. And I think we're clear that that's not the case with him. There was that moment, yes, but he is very much part of the canon and his work has been enormously influential.
Absolutely. What he taught me as a reader and as a writer is how funny life is, how life is funny even when it's very sad and tragic. And that's what I'm so particularly grateful for, his sense of humour and his generosity and the warmth that just comes through all of his writing.
Well, we are, I guess, kind of saying you perhaps needn't, if you are listening to this, feel that you must become a sort of Garcia Marquez completist and read this book too. But we are saying that there's nothing going to be lost by revisiting some of his greatest works. Is this an unsad note on which to leave it, do you think, Miranda?
Yes, very much so. I would say go and read No One Writes to the Colonel. It's about the same length and it's an absolutely beautifully written book.
Thank you very much for coming and talking to us about Until August and Gabriel Garcia Marquez today. Thanks, Miranda.
Thank you very much.
Now, we've had Camille Ralphs on the podcast before to talk about Dungeons and Dragons, which I remember very fondly, but mostly to talk about poetry, as she is the TLS's poetry editor. And this week, her first full-length collection, After You Were, I Am, is published. So we're delighted to have her on again to read us one of her new poems. Camille, thank you very much for coming.
Thank you for inviting me. It's great to be back on the podcast.
Well,
well,
I'm discussing...
we love to have poetry read out, don't we, Lucy?
We really
and
do.
It's, yeah. It's particularly nice if the TLS poetry editor comes and does it.
Yeah, it is. And so your new book, the structure of it is quite distinct, isn't it? Tell us about that, how it works, and about why you're being called a modern metaphysical.
I like that phrase.
Yeah,
like
it's good, that. Isn't it? I didn't make it up, I must confess here. It's good, I'm borrowing it.
So there are three sequences in the book. The first is a series of canonical or poetic prayers rewritten with modernity in mind. And some of those are based on poems by metaphysical poets, which is possibly where that's come from. The second is a suite of dramatic monologues in the voices of the Pendle witches who were tried in 1612. And the third is an engagement with the life, work and spiritual diaries of the Elizabethan occultist John Dee, on whom Shakespeare's Prospero was possibly based. And the theme of the three sequences is human fallibility and all the ways that's written into our history and language, which is another form of history, because etymology and the phrases we use without thinking contain a lot of truth and a lot of error. And I'm interested in sort of smashing them together in these poems and seeing what falls out.
I can't go on about how wonderful it is because you're from the TLS and it will sound incredibly log-rolly. But just my personal opinion is it's really terrific. Anyway, back to impartiality and neutrality. tell us about the poem, the particular poem that you're going to read from us and which section that comes from.
Sure. This one comes from the first section, the rewritten prayers, and it's vaguely modelled on a reflective prayer within a poem by Jalal al-Din Rumi, the 13th century Persian mystic, and is one of the more aphoristic poems in the book, sort of like a stack of aphorisms, really, that feed into one another and turn into a bigger idea. And Rumi's original is also very suggestive and elliptical like that. Mm-hmm. I think I pushed mine into a more determined through line, an argument, something along the lines of, it's hard to get an answer if you don't know to whom you're addressing the question, and it's hard to define anything when nothing's ever finished. And I think mine is also less celebratory. So the second line of Rumi's poem, for instance, is, we are the flute, our music is all thine. And you're about to hear something quite different in my version.
We are not the flute.
No. Something
yeah.
Okay.
And I'm sorry, I'm going to just drop impartiality again, having said I wasn't going to. And I must confess that I did ask Camille to read this one because, again, I think it's splendid. Anyway, I'm going to now leave you to it. Camille, go ahead.
After Jalal al-Din Rumi. What if the brain's pink impulses can only disappoint us? What if Y, wearing that black, backless address, is not a who? We are the ones who do the crimes, and yet you are the wanted one. The episodic soul is like a sitcom filmed in unreal time. To care about this sort of thing is as wise as a digital clock. But if the sky weren't trapped in days and nights revolving door, the undomesticable zodiac would use our every coffin litter as a tray. And arguably, London is more spit than shine for days. But does it not shine somewhere? Somewhere so clean we can see ourselves in everything. If you can, give voice to the throaty red anthurium, to the window, to the wall that makes these rooms matter and these stanzas matter. Through change, a whipping post becomes postmodern art. Through change, a second advent turns to venture capital. The episodic soul is moving at a quickening remove from this unchecked, unbalanced world of checks and balances, dances a totem dance and sings ototototoy at billions of creatures clocking off into the void. Then comes to us our look, like a black cat in a dark room purring ergonomically. Then sends it us price guns like tasers at our hips to value all the world, its messianic shabbiness. Both pearls and vinegars have mothers, it now seems, and the mother of invention is necessity. And boy, do we need you.
Still to come on the show, Nicola Shulman takes a peek at women's diaries through the ages.
And to read all the pieces we talk about and much more, remember to subscribe to the TLS. Just head on over to our website at the-tls.co.uk.
And if you've enjoyed what we've discussed so far this week, let me remind you that you can subscribe to this podcast for free wherever you normally get your podcasts, and you'll never miss an episode.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Welcome back to the TLS podcast. I'm Lucy Dallas. Now, we talked about Virginia Woolf's diaries on the podcast quite recently and about how they figured in her evolution and her practice as a writer. But we didn't talk really about what they meant for her as a woman. And there's a new book out called Secret Voices, A Year of Women's Diaries, edited by Sarah Gristwood. And Nicola Shulman has written about it for us. So, of course, we had to invite her back to talk it through. Nicola, thank you so much for joining us again.
It's a pleasure. Thank you for asking me.
Just talking about this idea of reading diaries, there is a kind of question, isn't there, about the kind of literary merits of diary writing, who it's for, whether the person writing it thinks it ever will be read. Is it their internal monologue or is it meant for a reader? How do these things read?
Well, you know, this is a book that's got really a lot of women over a lot of centuries. And so I can't say that there's really exactly a consensus, but I can say that there are quite a lot of women. And I wonder whether men do this. I wonder whether men sort of write diaries in quite the same way. I think it's completely different. So a lot of women kind of ask themselves whether it's even possible to write a diary. So Lady Charlotte Berry, for example, says, if nobody is ever to read what one writes, there is no satisfaction in writing. And if anybody does see, mischief ensues. So then she decides she's not going to write a diary. She's going to write what she calls brief notes. And then there's a person I very much sympathise with, who is Cynthia Asquith, I think was a personal assistant to Winston Churchill in the Second War. And she says that she's a useless diary writer because devoid of the gift of sincerity and incurably self-conscious. And so she can't write a word that she's sort of without imagining that somebody would read it. Mm. And I kind of feel that. I don't know whether any of you are diary writers. Well, I'm a very bad diary writer because I don't know who I'm writing for.
Yes, ditto.
And yeah, writing for yourself, I can totally get Cynthia Asquith, is kind of embarrassing.
She's actually one of the better diary writers here. She's very good, but I completely sort of feel that the sentiment is something I really
really sympathise with how difficult it is to write a diary, because it is very self-conscious. It's an act of self-consciousness. That's why I think that, you know, Virginia Woolf doesn't seem to have very much trouble with that aspect of it, of course, but she's more sort of, you know, self-critical. She says, oh, you know, this isn't really writing. And then she says, oh, well, maybe it is actually, because actually when I'm doing this, it's almost, you know, she thinks it's sort of almost automatic handwriting, and therefore tons of stuff that I might sort of filter out gets put down. So she's actually quite pleased with her diary, pleased enough that later on she says, oh, I must put it aside half an hour or an hour every day to do it, and I must make it a duty and I'll get used to it. And so she obviously did actually find it valuable after having that in sort of initial thing where she says, you know, I don't think this isn't writing.
It can move from the completely kind of private and confessional to a very self-conscious one with an eye on it being read later. I mean,
yes.
I think Virginia Woolf probably may have had an idea that, you know, that they might have been read.
I'm sure she did. She definitely did. And there are quite a few people here. I mean, there are some people, there are quite a few people in this book. There are quite a few famous diarists, not all of whom knew they were going to become famous diarists, but quite a few who did. You know, a lot of them have now actually been published. I think the Patricia Highsmith's diaries are published. Tina Brown. Why are we reading Tina Brown's diaries at all? Well, presumably because they've already been published, although she's still alive.
What I found so fascinating in your piece and what you say about, you know, Sarah Gristwood's idea about this is that maybe women find it hard because sometimes the diaries are an outlet for the kind of emotions, like, for example, anger, rage, jealousy, whatever it might be, that are just difficult to express if you are a woman in any case, even privately.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, Fanny Burney, you know, says, I don't know anybody well enough that I can write what I want to write. I don't have anybody in my acquaintance. There's nobody that there is no one to whom I am that close. So I am going to write to my diary and I will call it Dear Nobody, because there is nobody that I can talk to. I'm going to call it Nobody. I think I say in my piece, and that Sarah Gristwood notices very much, how much anger there are in these diary entries. And presumably she's partly chosen them because she's interested in that. She's interested by the sort of incredible frustration and fury that women have. And I mean, there's a wonderful passage here, Sophia Tolstoy, that extremely put upon woman. So let me just read you a bit that she says. So write about how ghastly it is to be married to a genius. For a genius, in italics, one has to create a peaceful, cheerful, comfortable home. A genius must be fed, washed and dressed, must have his works copied out innumerable times, must be loved and spared all cause for jealousy so that he can be calm. One must then feed and educate the innumerable children fathered by this genius, whom he cannot be bothered to care for himself, as he has to commune with all the Epictetuses, Socrateses, and Buddhas. And then when the members of his family circle have sacrificed their youth, beauty, everything to serve this genius, they are then blamed for not understanding geniuses properly. They never get a word of thanks for sacrificing their pure young lives to him, for atrophying their spiritual and intellectual capacities, which they are unable to nourish and develop due to a lack of peace, leisure, and energy.
So she was fine with everything. There was no...
Yeah, no problem at all. No wonder she had to write it all down. You wouldn't want to be going around trying to say that to your husband, would you?
No. Well, I think at this point he'd actually run away from her because we're on his final train journey. But I think it was his acolytes who, in addition, sort of, you know, who very much kind of demoralized and sort of diminished her as a kind of a person who didn't understand him. It must have been absolutely enraging.
And her diary, of course, didn't diminish her. So it completely makes perfect sense, doesn't it? It really
exactly.
does.
Exactly. That she grows in this diary, and she's actually, you know, she's a very impressive person. There are a lot of people who are very impressive, like, for example, an Inuit. As an Inuit woman called Ada Blackjack, and she was engaged by an expedition to Alaska. She was an Inuit woman, and she kind of found herself doing the work of four men, and on this expedition, which they were trying to claim for Britain, I think. And anyway, they all died apart from her, so served them right. But before that, you know, they beat her up, they screamed at her, they, you know, they threatened to kill her. They were just sort of, you know, they were angry men in sort of, you know, freezing in fur, and they're taking everything out on her. She's the only person they had to help, and she did everything. She was a seamstress. She learned survival skills, which is why she was the only one who lived. Eventually, she was living on seals on her own, and somebody, and she was found by a ship, and they'd all died.
Gosh, and she expresses all of that.
She expresses her extreme dismay at how ill-treated she is by these people who just expect her to work and work and work and work and to be able to just abuse her and take all their misfortune out on her. It's really interesting.
That's what you say seems to sort of power a lot of it, that the views can't usually, or certainly for a lot of them, they can't be expressed in any other way. The women simply cannot say this. They certainly can't say it to the men in their lives, and they can't say it to society. So do you think that's where a lot of the power comes from?
I do. And I think it's also the place where you can complain about that. There are a lot of women who state the position that they find themselves in and their dismay. But I think that in life, particularly up until the sort of latter part of the 20th century, or at least the 20th century, people didn't say those things out loud. About how ill-served they considered themselves. You know, here's Mary Boykin Chestnut, who's a famous diarist of the Civil War years in the southern states. I've seen a Negro woman sold upon the block at auction, she says, and she describes that. And she says, my very soul sickened, it was too dreadful. I tried to reason. You know how women sell themselves and are sold in marriage from queens downward, eh? You know what the Bible says about slavery and marriage. Poor women, poor slaves. So this is Mary Boykin Chestnut, basically sort of drawing a direct analogy between sort of, you know, slavery and just being a woman and trying to make herself feel better about this poor woman being sold. Because she'll say, well, doesn't it effectively happen to all of us? But that is perhaps not something that you could say not to your diary.
No, certainly not.
Yes, it's true that ignoble thoughts are the kind of thing, you know, as well as, you know,
as well as your righteous anger
and as well as your own feelings about the circumstances that you're being put in by others. We all know that diaries, you know, hold out the promise of showing people sides of ourselves that we really wouldn't want them to see, things that we ourselves are not very proud of. So are they, in a sense, a kind of, a little bit of a receptacle for the id, or am I overdoing?
I think they are, but funnily enough, not so much in this. There's not very much bitchiness in this or cattiness in this selection. I don't know whether that's deliberate, because you would think that people would be being more rude about other people, but they're not, and it might be just because because Griswold thought this is too complicated, because people don't know who this person is, and I'm going to have to do it in a note, or it won't be clear, because, you know, they're only quite short passages, so maybe you can't do that quite sort of, you know.
Does Sarah Griswold, does she explain sort of how she chose them? She must have had just the most enormous amount of material to choose from. Is it chronological?
That's insane. I mean, the earliest one is the first years of the 17th century. The last one is about 2011, so she's got a lot. Does she? Well, she sometimes selects in order to tell a brief, coherent story, and I think that's a very good idea. She's drawn a, you know, she's identified a sort of a question, and she follows it through, like, you know, a person gets pregnant, or will they be able to get an abortion? Then you see them going to the abortionist, and how much the abortionist charges, and how costly it is, and what it's like, and all this kind of thing. So that's sort of one story. And then there's a story of Anne Morrow Lindbergh, who's the wife of Charles Lindbergh, an aviator and politician, whose child is snatched, son is kidnapped. And so that you follow her sort of agony of, is he dead? Will he ever appear again? This kind of thing, you know, children are sick. Will they recover? Will they die? And then, of course, there's Dostoevsky's wife, who's constantly dealing with his gambling. And he sort of comes home in total despair, sort of, as far as I can see, five nights out of six, because he's once again been been irresistibly drawn to the gambling tables, right, to the gaming tables, and has lost all the money that, you know, that he's been paid, or that he yeah. And then every now and again he wins something, and then he comes home, and then she's awfully nice, and then she's all, you know, so pleased for him, and they dance around and she's delighted, and then he goes off the next day and spends it all.
Moral of this piece is, don't marry a great Russian writer, isn't it?
It doesn't sound like the best.
Don't find yourself married to one of the greats of Russian literature.
Read the books, but don't marry the blokes.
Read the books, but don't marry the guys. If I were to write a diary, I think it probably would be a sort of variation of Don't You Hate It When Your Friends Become Successful. It would just be a sort of endless, you know, God, did you see that great thing happen to someone else? I'm fuming. Yes. But one hopes it's something. Now, funnily enough, in a great teetering pile of reading that I've got to do at the moment, or I have to do, you know, I'm enjoying doing, of course, but I've had to burrow into a comfort read to denote the difference between work reading and pleasurable readings. I've gone back to a favourite. So I'm reading The Woman in White for the umpteenth time. And that is all different kinds of narratives, as we know, put together. And our great heroine in the book, Marion Holcomb, we're reading her diary. And what strikes me as that, I've been thinking about it, because she is a rather sort of overlooked character in certain ways, in which she's not the love heroine of the book, but she's engaged on a lot of diplomacy. She's always trying to make sure everyone is in balance, feels okay, that the interests of her sister are protected, that she, all these feelings that can't be spoken not only by herself but by others, are somehow contained. And it strikes me that perhaps diaries do function, as well as being a receptacle for anger, as this sort of space for emotional containment, where you sort of work these frightening kind of things out in order to in some way keep the peace.
Yes, I completely see that. And actually, it's funny you should say that, because two of the Bronte sisters, I think both Emily and Anne, have these very strange diary entries where they place everybody who's in the house with them, like placing figures in a doll's house. Mm. Okay, Emily is ironing upstairs. I am sitting in the dining room downstairs in the rocking chair. Papa is in the parlour. Tabby and Martha are, I think, in the kitchen. And I think that Emily does it too. It's like opening the front of their house.
Ooh,
and you suddenly can see them all in their different little rooms. And it's such a strange thing to do, to take this moment where everybody is placed in their place. And this is almost like something of sort of a safe making or balancing thing.
I was going to say, making sure everybody is, I know where they are, they're all accounted for.
They're all accounted for. And it is a little bit like playing, you know, it is, if it feels when you read it, like sort of putting the figure in the room. Because it doesn't really say, I mean, maybe the passage isn't long enough to then say, you know, that, I don't know, then they all start
Bramwell's drunk again.
Or Bramwell's drunk again. Bramwell's probably off in Switzerland or something. But
finished novel. Yes, it doesn't, yeah.
Well, you do say also in your piece, and this is perhaps against what we might expect, that the best diarists often turn out to be teenage girls.
It's amazingly surprising that, when I consider my own.
I know, I was going to say, I don't mind.
I could not have been more surprised. How brilliant some of these teenage girls are, how unself-conscious in a way, how kind of just overrunning with sort of enthusiasm and interest and curiosity. This, I particularly love this person, Joan Wyndham. Became a writer, a sort of literary figure in London, and she's about 19, and she basically writes about sex all the time. She's fascinated by sex, so she's completely sort of gives the lie to the idea that sort of like the sort of nicely brought up young ladies didn't think about this kind of thing. So I think she's in the WAF, or she might be in the Wrens. Anyway, they have a party. This is what she says. About midnight, I began to feel a bit tired, so took two Benzedrin, which kept me nicely sober in spite of gin, creme de menthe, rum, and Algerian wine.
Wow.
I did a wildly improvised eightsome with hands, and even wilder Schottischer. My suspender belt bust in the middle of it, front suspenders only, thank God, so I carried gamely on like a plane on one engine. There's something so charming about her.
Very, and also just quite impressive after, I mean, you know.
I bet she wasn't nicely sober on all no, that.
This is, absolute wonder. I love the idea that she's nicely sober.
It's only your suspender belt that goes after that great rake of drinks. But no, wow, goodness me.
That's very
quite actually, because afterwards she does get pulled down onto a dusty floor. Anyway, she writes about all of those things. She's not at all sort of arch about it. She's just very kind of interested, but very funny about her sort of sexual experiences and about how, you know, her and all the other girls in the place where she's living, there's a party and they try to get off with as many people as they can. She says, I got six, you know.
She's going for it. That's
to get
wonderful.
The troops.
Yeah, exactly. And you also say that there are obviously lots of famous names that you've talked about there, but they're not always the most compelling ones. Can you tell us a little bit, because she sounds wonderful, about Housewife 49?
Nella Last is a housewife from Barrow-in-Furness who joins up for the observation project, and she starts to write a diary. And what you notice is that over time, you know, at the beginning she's very kind of nervous and fluttery, and she's all indecisive and worried about, you know, what can she feed people? Should she open a tin of peaches, or is that too extravagant? You know, every little thing is something to kind of concern herself over. And then she gets into war work and she becomes a sort of very different person. She becomes much more confident. She starts noticing how her friends have changed, how she starts going out more. She starts to dread coming home where her ghastly husband is sitting there waiting for his tea. And you see her gaze upon him becoming more and more sort of direct and absorbing and horrified. She can't sort of almost believe how ghastly he is, how little he has to recommend him, and how she has sort of subsumed all her personality to him willingly. To this not very admirable person, to this not very interesting person. And she suddenly is filled with rage, fury. You know, she's like, why? What, you know, why is there all this lord and master? Well, you know, we're going to have a little bit less of that now. Why do I have to do what you say? Why do I have to feel that I'm useless just because you say that I am? Why can't we go out just because you don't ever want to go anywhere? And she turns into a different person. It's really the doing of the diary that gives her this strength to realise that she's an interesting person and that she doesn't deserve to be treated like this, and that she is better than the life that she is accepted. And you see this, it's really fascinating.
A kind of self-actualization project.
Yeah.
It's wow. Gosh. Mm.
Well, it sounds wonderful. So it sounds as though you would recommend this, would you?
I would recommend it. I mean, it's a strange book because all this it's got these stories that go through it, which I think are the most interesting thing. It's not a perfect book. The fact that it's the 7th of April means completely different things to different people. It doesn't ground anybody in that time, because the 7th of April doesn't really mean it. So when you get around Christmas, that kind of thing, maybe people have a sort of shared experience. But apart from that, they're really just floating on these days. They don't have connections. Do you see what I mean?
Yes, precisely,
of course.
But there's enough kind of richness in the experience to...
Oh, yeah. No, I liked it a lot. And as I say, as I think I say in the piece, you should really read it through and not open it randomly. Because if you open it randomly, you'll miss its great, I think it's great merit, which is to pick up these stories that she's found. And you get interested in people, then you also start to identify people by their style, so that if you can't see who they are, and you start to read the bottom of the page, you think, oh yeah, Mary Shelley, there she goes.
Yeah, listen, Nicola, thank you so much for guiding us through this, and we managed to end not on a note of rage, so well done us.
Yes.
Thank you so much.
That's hard to do. Thank you very much. Thank you for asking me.
That's all we have time for this week. Our thanks go to Miranda France, Camille Ralphs, and Nicola Shulman.
And thank you for listening to this episode of the TLS podcast, produced by Charlotte Pardee.
We'll be back next week, but for now, from Lucy Dallas and from me, Alex Clark, goodbye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.